accession number 10923, reel 13.
Mr. Harold Harper, reel 13. We got to the stage where your gun had been taken out of action for rebarrelling.
That's right. The whole of the 8th Army was on the move. And my first problem was to find Remy workshops. And when I tell you that I found them about 800 miles farther on, in other words, we just literally joined the queue going up the main road up the desert. Eventually I found them, got the gun barrel put in. Then the job was to find the regiment. And this was quite a job because all we could do, we had no rations around. We were calling it at transit camps like Merzmetru and places like that, staying there a couple of nights to reorganise ourselves. It was quite something uncanny, really, because to be away from one's regiment for such a long time, knowing that you had got a gun which ought to be in action, and that there was probably some need for it, to a certain extent placed quite a heavy responsibility on myself, because obviously the crew were in no hurry to get back. I realised that I've got to get back as soon as possible. Anyway, altogether, I was away. We were away from the battery for well over a fortnight. And we eventually caught up with them at, about 100 miles south of Benghazi, near this particular monument that Mussolini had built. I'm trying to think of the name of it. It was a well-known area in the desert. No, it eludes me at present. But that's where we found them.
What did they say?
Now, well, yes, I duly appeared, and there was a gun pit or gun position already laid out for me. I hadn't been in position for above half an hour before the message came that the battery commander wanted to see me, so I thought, hello, I've got some explaining to do. And quite frankly, I was amazed when the battery commander told me that I was being taken off the guns and given the responsibility of battery quartermaster sergeant. So instead of receiving a rebuke, I was promoted.
How did you feel about that? The job you were...
I remember distinctly the words of the battery commander to me in his little sort of bivouac, in which he said, up till now, you'll have been getting all the praise, everybody will have been sort of saying, well done, fantastic job, you've done this to the enemy and goodness knows what else, which of course we did. He said, from now on, he said, you're going to find that nobody's going to praise you. He said, in fact, the only thing you'll get will be brickbacks. I said, thank you very much. And it's perfectly true, of course, in an administrative position. Nobody is inclined to pat you on the back.
Now, you joined them at Marble Arch, I think it's called.
Marble Arch is the word I was after. Thank you very much indeed.
And this was after there'd been a battle just before. Now, had you missed that?
I'd missed that, yes. But it had been a very minor battle, quite frankly.
Now, what were your new duties? Did you run through what the job was?
Well, the battery quartermaster sergeant, quite simple to run through those, because you were responsible for all equipment, rations, water, everything which was needed to keep the battery in the field. Simple as that, really.
And how did it's simple to describe? And of course, how did you go about it, though?
Well, of course, we Our first main contact was through the regimental head quartermaster sergeant, who was an officer. The regimental quartermaster.
This would be the 7th Medium.
The 7th Medium Regimental Quartermaster, that's right. Who was an old Indian sergeant major who had been promoted to captain.
Indian Army.
I got on with him very well. I was full of intrepidation at the start, but as to how he would treat a weekend soldier. But we did very well together.
And, what staff did you have at your end?
I had a Russian bombardier. I had a water cart driver who was a Lance bombardier. I had my own assistant in the quartermaster's truck. I had a motor mechanic. The artificer came under me as well. And I also had a chappie we described as a general chappie. He was a woodwork bloke and goodness knows what else, who could do all the odd jobs. And a number of drivers. So really, I probably had a staff of about 14 or 15. Yeah.
Now, did you have to weld them into a team or?
No, in all fairness, the previous quartermaster had got the thing organised, although there was a sort of laxity which had to be tightened up a little bit, but nevertheless, the framework was there when I arrived here.
And how did you, what was the actual procedure for getting food and things from this RSM?
The regimental quartermaster. Well, they in turn were in touch with the RASC, and we were then instructed. The problem always was to maintain what the strength. You had to keep a reliable figures on what the strength of the battery was. Strength meaning the numbers.
How did you go about that?
I had to call for reports every so often to make sure I was getting the right ration strength. And of course, the important day of the week was when you drew the cigarette rations to make sure everybody got their rations. And of course, also came into that field things like special visits to the NAFI. If one happened to know there was an AFI truck in the area, then you sort of, without any hesitation, you went back to it quickly and got what you could.
The urgency
was always there to do what one could for the battery.
Where would you get the money to build a special AFI?
Now you've got me thinking. Now the money. Oh, we got battery funds for special things like that.
And you just decide how much and what to buy.
That's right. No, there was never any objection. It was a question if you could get it. I mean, people had got the money anyway because there was nothing to spend anything on.
Now, you say that it was your job. You get criticism in this sort of job.
Oh, yes.
What sort of things would they criticise you about or did criticise you about?
Well, if the rations weren't there on time. And that was not always easy, because you probably, the RSC might have moved on and all that sort of business. It was not easy, because you had to do a lot of work in the night. You often found yourself doing a journey of 200 or 300 miles in the night and finding your way back. And when you got back, you found the battery had moved. That was the sort of thing, and consequently, because of that, you may have been late with the rations, or may have been late. But certainly the priority always was to make sure the guns were in action and that you got plenty of ammunition for them.
That wouldn't come from the RASC, would it?
No, the ammunition would come from the... came from the... I don't know. I'm trying to think. Royal Ordnance, I think it was, who looked after the shells, yeah.
And how would you collect it?
There'd be we would collect it by sending down a convoy of 3-ton lorries, or AECs.
But that would take priority over the food?
If there was any doubt, the ammunition would have to take priority over the food. If there was any... I don't think I had to make that decision above 2 or 3 times, but certainly if you've got drivers available for ammunition and you wanted food as well, the ammunition came first.
So you were in this Marble Arch area. Where were you moving to?
Oh, we were moving gradually up the desert towards Tripoli. But obviously it was in... that certain area that we started to get a bit of resistance. The Germans have still got a few bombers knocking around, dive bombers, although their air force obviously had been well and truly pushed back.
Was the supply... it's a long thing for the supplies. Did you start to... overrun your supply train at all? Or were you aware of it, that they were having trouble with the supply situation?
Yes.
How did it show itself? Because your line of communications was getting very
getting
long.
Longer, that's right, yes. I wasn't in this job very long. That's why I might be a little bit vague here, but... Yes, we have. I suppose the only way we felt this was we found that we were going back bigger distances or longer distances to get water and supplies. But if I may go on, one of these areas, Captain Birkin rejoined the battery.
This is Ivor Birkin.
Captain Ivor Birkin. And he'd come all the way up from Cairo, having been in South Africa. He come up all the way from Cairo and he finished up in the wagon lines, of which I was in charge. And I greeted him because let's face it, I hadn't seen him for about 6 months at least. I greeted him with a cup of tea and what have you. And his first remark to me was, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I'm Battery Quartermaster Sergeant." "Oh," and he said, "We'll see about that." And this was before he got back to the regiment. And lo and behold, within about 3 weeks... I was Troop Sergeant Major, back in the firing line, so my...
So it was only really from December to late January, early February?
I was back, yes, certainly, Troop Sergeant Major within... I was BKMS at Christmas, but I was certainly Sergeant Major by January.
You mentioned Christmas. Did you have any special responsibility?
Yes, we had to do what we could at Christmas for the troops. Not much. We were right out at Marble Arch at Christmas, in the most bleak part of the desert. And what we did, I think, I went back to the NAFI, which had been established in Benghazi, which by then was about 200 or 300 miles away. And did what we could to get something special for the lads. I remember getting back on... one of the officers coming to me and saying, "We ought to do something about Christmas." And I said, "Well, what date is it?" And he said, "Well, it's December the 20th. And I said, "Well, that's great." I said, "Because I've just had a birthday and didn't realise I'd had it." My birthday being December the 13th, so that had passed unnoticed, which goes to show how sort of detached from real life we were out in the blue, as we call it. in the desert. So we did manage, I think, to get one or two extra little special items for Christmas, but not much.
Quite. Do you remember Harding's inspection? He was the commander of 7th Armoured Division. Do you remember him? He came in January. Do you remember his inspection?
I wasn't there, no. No, I wasn't at his inspection, I'm sure.
So you were now going to be Troop Sergeant Major?
Troop Sergeant Major of B Troop.
What did that entail?
The general supervision of all the men in the troop. Making sure that the gun detachments were properly fed, properly equipped, that they were up to strength as much as best we could, and above all to make sure they were all equally supplied with ammunition. And that's just about the full responsibility of the sergeant major. Of course, linked with the officers, and in my case, of course, I was able to help on the survey side. Very, very often stepping on and letting the GPR have a 2 or 3 hours sleep and I would take over. That sort of thing.
So you had quite a varied list of things you...
Oh, yes. I think each troop sergeant major made his own sort of rules as to what he actually did, but I mean the general rules were you were responsible for the welfare and the safety as to the best extent of the troops.
What about the efficiency of the troop and the discipline?
Yeah, discipline and the efficiency was it had got to be there definitely, but that wasn't difficult because by then everybody was acclimatised. I mean, they'd sort of lived together for such a long time. The response was always there when you wanted them. The biggest problem with a sergeant major's job was when you weren't in action. In case one or two of the blokes went off the rails a little bit, but I never had any difficulties with the chaps when they were in action at all.
When you now reached the rank, you were senior NCO now, when you'd first joined the army and you went to your first camp, you hadn't really liked it, you know, and you wanted to get back home, basically. Did that give you a sympathetic attitude to men suffering from problems in the desert? Or?
Yes. Yes, that was definitely one of the main duties of a troop sergeant major, was to be able to talk with the lads if they had any sort of domestic problems. They were few and far between because, let's face it, their contact with their families was almost nil. But there was the odd occasion when the letter came from home about various problems, and you did your best with the help of an officer to see what can be done. There was no question ever of sending a bloke home. Because don't forget at that time the Germans still ruled the Mediterranean with their U-boats.
What about...
And the thoughts in those days of sending anybody home by air was impossible because the airplanes wouldn't do it.
What about men who were getting a bit jittery or men that were...
Yeah, that was another thing. I'm pleased you asked that question. If you saw any signs of jitteriness, then it was your job as a sergeant major to try and... by various means at your disposal to overcome that jitteriness. Sometimes by cracking a joke, sometimes by applying pressure.
How would you apply pressure?
Well, I sort of telling a bloke what his responsibilities were, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But invariably you did it by applying a joke.
Did men like yourself who'd been out there now for a long time, did you start to build up battle fatigue yourself? I mean, would you get jittery more easily than you had or not?
No. As I previously said my worst moments were after the Knightsbridge, when I think it was the question one was shattered and felt very depressed. But don't forget now that victory was in the air. We were being carried on a wave of victory. We knew that back home people like Churchill were extolling our virtues. We knew that we were the only British army in action, and this great pride in being the only one victorious army was something which we really gave a lot of ego.
Now, what happened next then from January? There's an engagement at a place called Zemzem, I think. Do you remember much about that?
It's very difficult to remember all these engagements because they were very, very numerous. But
what was the pattern of fighting in this period then? I mean,
it was very mobile, very mobile. In fact, the question of gun pits now was out of it was just a question of dropping the gun on the ground and firing away. And the observation car sort of going ahead, linking with the tanks, and because it was nearly all tank warfare advanced, because the infantry obviously weren't engaged at that time. It was very close liaison, obviously, with the Air Force, because there was always the danger on when you're moving fast forward of being bombed by your own people. And so we had to have a very close liaison with the Air Force. Zemzem, I can't quite remember. There were so many peculiar names given to all these little battles. When I say little battles, that's not very... because there's always a bit of a flare-up. I think the next main battle I can remember after Alamein was Marath. There we'd sort of lined up for probably a few days prior to Marath, and this we now got into very mountainous country, as opposed to we'd been used to the flat open desert. This was something entirely different from what we'd experienced, and the problem there at Marath was finding a gun position which was not obvious. And it was... we found ourselves pitched between two mountains in the valley. And it was obvious to any... you'd have to be an idiot of a German general not to know where that artillery was coming from. And so consequently, they brought into action for the very first time a mortar which was known as a Nebelwerper, which screamed as it came over, sounding like an organ grinding, and that they used to great effect and plastered this valley where we were at Marath. There was no escaping it, quite frankly, but it must have been a little a sort of a rearguard action by the Germans, because we managed to break through eventually. But there we were stuck for about 4 or 5 days. Literally had to take all that was thrown at us. And this valley was only about 400 or 500 yards across, so there was not much room to put two troops of artillery. Yeah.
Now, one point I wanted to ask you, how were you working with the 7th Medium Regiment? I mean, how was that arrangement working out? Because you were just the South Notch Hussar Battery,
right,
at this
That's
point,
right,
weren't you?
We, at Alamein, there was this great distinction between the two. As I say, we were a made-up battery. They were pretty well a battery which had come out intact. 2728 battery, as they were known as. They were firing 4-5s, which was equipment which they had been issued with for a number of years. We got equipment which we had, no one had ever fired, and so we were very much the inferior boys. By the time of Alamein and afterwards, we were obviously on a par, and we were told so by various senior individuals. I would think by the end of the African campaign, we'd pass them.
Did you get on well with them?
Very well indeed. If we were completely out of action and in an area where we could relax to a certain extent, then we were encouraged to mix as sergeants with the regular sergeants, and we got on very well.
Did you feel you were part of the same regiment, or did you think you were? I mean, did you feel you were part of the 7th Regiment?
Yes. No. We never felt that. We still felt that we were South Notts Hussars. We still kept our cap badge.
The other thing is, I missed it out actually before you got to Marath. Do you remember anything about the taking of Tripoli?
Well, I don't actually, because Tripoli obviously was a landmark in the whole of the desert campaign. The taking of Tripoli was probably one of the easiest parts of the whole campaign. And what happened there was we skirted Tripoli to the south and went on after the enemy. In the meantime, of course, Churchill appeared in Tripoli, and the 51st Highland Div got all their kilts and what have you out, and which they apparently carried with them in special trucks, and did this parade through the city, which was appeared on the newsreels in England, which gave the impression that the jocks had captured the place, which was all wrong. I mean, it was merely a parade through possibly the biggest town in North Africa, or certainly in Libya.
Now, you went back to Tripoli just after after the capture. Do you remember the parade with Churchill?
Well, no, I didn't see that. I was only aware that there'd been a parade. I actually didn't see it.
What else do you remember about Marath?
All I can remember about the Tripoli was the fact that on the approach to Tripoli, we saw vegetation for the first time ever in the desert. Unbelievable. So much so we were helping ourselves to potatoes and what have you. We'd never seen any fresh vegetables for a long time.
Now, getting back to Marath, sorry about that, I put you back to that, but how did the fighting develop at Marath? You were under this bombardment from the Netherlands.
When you say how did it develop, obviously we had an observation post out, and we were firing consistently. I had an unusual experience at Marath, which I'll tell you about. We were shelled, and I dived into a trench, which was only a shallow trench, not a long way from the cookhouse. Because by then I was the troop sergeant major, so I was obviously in the rear of the guns at the time. So I lay myself flat on this very shallow trench and suddenly felt this terrifically burning sensation in my back. By then, of course, I'd seen many, many, many blokes wounded and killed. And I felt this fluid trickling down my back. So I thought, this is it. I expected to find a huge hole in my back and that. It transpired that the shell had hit the cookhouse. The cook had got on a big dixie full of McConaughey's stew, which he used to put in tins, and he used to put the tins into the boiling liquid, then open the tins afterwards, you see. And one of these tins had flown into the air and landed on my back. And what was running down my back was McConaughey's stew, not blood. So that...